Okay, we want to get going now. Good to see everyone. Hope you had a good week. Hope you really enjoyed reading all that fun stuff this week. By the way, on the Humanist Manifesto 2 document that you read, there were about, I don't know, 8 or 10 or 12 names signed at the end. At the end of the full document, there are pages of people who have signed. Most of the people you've ever heard of in academia, most of the people who are responsible for writing a lot of the textbooks that are still being used in universities signed that document. It was pretty interesting. But it just went on for pages. Let me pray. We'll get going. Father, thank you so much that we can come together and study openly. I pray that you would make this an encouraging and challenging evening for us to think through things a little deeper than we have before. God, I pray you'd help me to be fair and not to try to build straw men and burn them down. But help me to be fair and accurate in the way I present different people and what they've said and that sort of thing. Pray you'd use this in each one of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, we started with a thesis last week that God has revealed himself to every human person, past, present, and future, and every person has responded to God in some form or fashion, responded to who he is, responded to his revelation of himself in some form or fashion. And what we're going to do tonight is start with the question, where do we come from? Where do we come from? How has mankind responded to the reality that there is a creator God? How have they responded to that reality? And what we're going to look at tonight are five alternate worldviews and how they have responded. And then next week, we're going to look at how the Bible addresses that question of where do we come from? When you look at those five alternate worldviews, if you have that colored chart, you might want to grab that from the front of your notebook. We looked at this last week just briefly, but you might want to grab that. And the five alternate worldviews are named at the top of that. You may go to other sources and try to find those worldviews. Good luck. Okay? Those are inventions in my mind of trying to sift through all of the philosophers you're going to see presented here in this semester are people that I've read, that I've realized have influenced us, and I've tried to break them down instead of 35 different philosophies, I've tried to break them down into these categories. So that's where those worldviews are coming from. I don't know that they're anywhere else that I've ever seen listed this way. If they are, it is a miracle because I don't know how they would have come up with it other than through my mind somehow. But if you look at those views, you'll notice the far two on the left are theistic views. They believe in a God. If you said, "Do you believe in God?" they would say, "Yes, we believe in God." But they are two different forms of theistic views. One is personal. They believe in a person who is God. And the impersonal believes there's a God but does not believe it's a person. Then on the far right, you'll notice the yellow and the orange columns there, the atheistic views of God, and the same thing. One of them is impersonal. There is no God. There is an ultimate something, but it's impersonal. It's an it. It's a thing. But then there is a personal atheistic substitute. They would say, no, there is no God. If you ask them, do you believe in God? They would say no, but they would refer to something or someone personal as being that which is ultimate, has ultimate power and authority. And in most cases, that would be you or me, human beings, and that sort of thing. So it's personal. Even though they don't believe in God, they believe there's an ultimate someone that exists. And then in the middle is the compromise, dualistic substitute. And really, the main person to fit there, even though we'll look at other people who touch on this, the person who really got this going was Plato. If any of you have picked up Nancy Piercy's book, Total Truth, and begun reading that, you will notice that she spends a lot of time on Plato, because he was very influential in the world we live today. Even though he lived 400 years before Christ, he is still having an ongoing influence in the way we look at the world today in many different ways, and that compromised dualistic view. In other words, we can live in two planes, two different worlds altogether. And that is defined in different ways by different people, those two different worlds that we can live in. But he's the one who introduced that idea and championed that the most. So with that in mind, let's look at your notes. We've got about 6 pages of notes to get through. You've got all the reading you did, and then you'll come to the page that says creation, where do we come from, considering alternate worldviews. And there, the first band, it says, the first modern philosopher, Benedict de Spinoza. And we want to look at him briefly. I don't want to labor this too much, but at the beginning of each of our times, every week, we're going to highlight a person in history that has helped shape things for us, whether they're a person who believed in an alternate worldview or they're a person who believed in the biblical worldview. So next week we'll look at somebody else who helped shape some of the biblical worldview that we have today. But this particular person, Benedict de Spinoza, he's considered one of the, many would consider him the father of modern philosophy, as I put there in your notes. There's another person, John Locke, was born the exact same year as Benedict de Spinoza, and together they are looked at as the fathers of modern-day philosophy. And we'll look at Locke in a few weeks. We'll talk a little bit more about him. But I want to personalize this guy named Spinoza. Spinoza had an interesting background. His heritage was Portuguese, but he was born in Amsterdam. And the reason he was born in Amsterdam, even though he was Portuguese, is because his parents, before he was born, were given the ultimatum by the Catholic Church in Portugal. You have 3 choices. You can either become a Catholic, you can run for your life, or you can die. Everyone who lived in Portugal. And his parents were very devout Jews. So they fled for their lives. They fled all the way to Amsterdam, and then Benedict de Spinoza was born. He was born there, raised in a very strict Jewish sect. When he was 2 years old, his mother died. When he was 22 years old, his father died. And he was still living at home at that point. But Benedict de Spinoza was a brilliant thinker. Most people in that day, most of the educational forms were just, here are the facts, memorize them, and regurgitate them. Rote memory was the way most learning was done in that day. And Benedict Spinoza thought outside the boxes of the traditions, thought outside the boxes of this is the way it's always been, these are the facts, and he would question those things. And so there were a lot of issues that his father had as he was growing up, going and being educated in this strict Jewish sect school. He would ask questions, and he would ask embarrassing questions. It would frustrate those who were teaching him. They felt disrespected because of the questions he asked, that he was even asking a question, but they felt very disrespected, and he was always getting in trouble, and his father was always having to go smooth things out with the school. And finally, when his father died, he was 22 years old, he was out of school, but he began to say some things and write some things that got noticed. 2 years after his father died, he was kicked out of that strict Jewish sect that he was a part of. He was excommunicated. That means you are no longer welcome among us, which means you're no longer welcome around here. Go. So he fled. He left. And he lived basically as a hermit the rest of his life. He only lived to be 45. He was 24 when he got kicked out. His parents had been kicked out by the Christians out of Portugal. He was kicked out by the Jews in Amsterdam. He didn't have a lot of good feelings about either one, Jews or Christians, because of his background and what he'd experienced. And he became, at the age of 24, a lens grinder. So for 21 years, the rest of his life, he spent his days, he made his living grinding lenses for spectacles, for glasses. He did that during the day. But he was a hermit, and he had lots of time to read and to study and to think and to write. Now, if you'll notice, when he was born, 1632, something had happened about 100 years before that was very significant, and that was the invention of the printing press. And Benedict de Spinoza started writing things, and his writing got turned into publications. This hermit, lens grinder, was writing this stuff, and it got spread and circulated, and more people started accumulating his books, and he started having an influence. Long after he was dead, his influence was spreading all over Western Europe and eventually into America as well. He was a person who influenced thinking in general. He was a logician. He reintroduced Plato's idea of thinking, reasoning, logic, and he came up with rules of logic. He's not the only one, but he was doing that at a time when not many were doing that. And he reintroduced some of the thinking of Plato, and he became popular, and so Plato became popular. He influenced mathematics. He influenced a lot of what happens in mathematics. He was a psychologist. He was interested in how we think and process and deal with life. And he studied that and wrote a lot about that. He was an ecologist. He is probably, in fact, in many circles, you will see Benedict de Spinoza referred to as the father of ecology, taking care of the world around us in a responsible way. He would be referred to as that, the father of that, and obviously as well a philosopher. Now, the thing that's unique about him, we looked at those two just briefly a minute ago, those two theistic views of God, and we looked at the atheistic views of God. Benedict de Spinoza, in many ways, was the first one to go to that impersonal theistic view of God. He's one of the first ones, he is the first one well-written in the Western world to go to that. He introduced that in the Western world. Now, it had been around for a long time in the Eastern world through Hinduism, through Buddhism, through Taoism. All of those were offsprings of Hinduism. And that idea of the world is the universe in which we live is the collective God. It has a force or a power with all the pieces of the universe put together. It creates a force or a power that is greater than all the parts themselves. And that is who God is. Well, if you ask Benedict de Spinoza, as a Western thinker and influencer, do you believe in God? He was a highly religious man, a worshiper of God. And he would say, absolutely, I believe in God, and it is very good. Referring to the world, the universe in which we live, this collective that is the God. And he popularized that for the very first time in the Western world, which carried over into America eventually as well. If you'll look at the very bottom, the last paragraph, I mentioned three things about him. First, he believed in what he called God, but his God was a pantheistic view of God. Second, since God was the universe and the earth a part of that, then God had certain rules of nature that man must follow, or God, nature, would punish him or her for breaking these laws of nature or of God. And third, one of the natural laws of that God, which is nature, which is creation, this universe, has given mankind was the inalienable right to pursue freedom, even from the governments that God had instituted, if the government did not honor man's rights or certain freedoms. We had the right to do that. So he introduced some of that thinking, and we're going to talk more about that tonight. Now, let's move on to the next page. Enough about him. But you get some idea of what he went through that led to some of the views that he thought about. Most people don't take time to look at his history very well. On page 2 there in your notes, a couple of things. First of all, initial considerations. We can run through these pretty quickly. Number 1, the response that a person or a system have to this first question, where do we come from, is most often a determining factor in answering the rest of the questions. In other words, the next question we're going to look at in a couple of weeks is, why are we here? Well, it makes a lot of sense that where we came from has a bearing on answering, why are we here? We're here, we got here somehow, and the how we got here has some bearing upon why we're here. And it works on down through the questions that way. Secondly, the first question, where do we come from, is the question that more than any other wrestles with the question of the existence of God. Does God exist or not? From the beginning of time, literally, God was the response to where did we come from. For millennia, that was the response by virtually everyone who existed on this planet. Now then, man has responded and gone far beyond that and has other responses as well. But it wrestles with the existence of God, as we'll look at tonight. Thirdly, the most profound and overall influential thinkers in history realized no matter which other questions they dealt with, they all pressed back to this question. For instance, Immanuel Kant, we'll study a little bit more about him a little bit tonight and some more as we go through the weeks here. Immanuel Kant was a fervent believer in God. And he wrote about how we could know God existed. But when he referred to God, he was, and by the way, he did that because part of his reasoning was we could not exist apart from God. I mean, he developed an apologetic that our very existence is dependent upon the reality of God. But when he talked about God, he would basically say, we can't learn about God here in this book. We learn about God here, reasoning, and through experience in life. That's how we learn about God. So even though he wrote books defending the existence of God, he was talking about a different kind of a God and how we find that God in different ways than the Bible talks about it. But he realized how important this question was, where do we come from? And he defended the existence of God as the creator above all things. Number 4. Worldview presuppositions that are essentially rooted in human reason, logic, and thinking instead of supernatural revelation, like this, always lead to a flawed and diminished worldview, leading to increased personal and social disorder, as we will see as we go through this semester. But anytime we base our worldview upon thinking, reason, logic alone, it's always going to lead us astray. And it's going to lead, as I say there, to flawed and diminished thinking about worldview, what life's all about. All worldviews have a group of presuppositions. We'll talk about those even when we talk about the Bible. But if it starts here, if this is the way we find it, is through our mind, reason, logic, or, as Kant talked about, through a personal experience, then we're in for trouble. Okay, look at the bottom of the page. Just a few quick points there as well, and then the top of the next page. A story behind present-day Western worldview considerations. Let me just, I'm not going to do this every week, but for this week, I feel like I need to do it. How did we get to where we are today historically? How did it develop? Number one, there was a rebirth of individual reasoning, logic, and philosophical thinking in many realms of life, from politics and social order to philosophy and scientific observation to religion and metaphysics, or that which is outside the physical world, from 1500 to 1900. So after what's called the Dark Ages, in the 1500s, some interesting things began to happen. For all those millennia, like I had said before, most everything had been tradition. You were brought up, this is the way we've always done it. This is the way it will always be done. In every area, the world had always been flat. The world's always going to be flat. Okay? That's what was taught. This is what we learn, this is how we learn it, and it's always going to be that way. That's the way it was in education. This is what we believe about God. This is what we've always believed. This is what we always will believe. And this is how we will practice our faith. It's always been that way with our people, and it will always be that way. This is how a nation runs, a people runs. There has always been a king. There will always be a king. There will always be the rich, and there will always be the poor, and there will be a great divide in between them, and the king comes out of that rich group. That's the way it's always been, and it always will be. And they had grown up with that for millennia of time. How did that begin to change? This is in around 1500, things began to change. Think about these things that happened in the 1500s. Machiavelli wrote The Prince. And for the first time, a publication, remember the printing press was in the 1500s as well, for the first time a printing press was printing books by Machiavelli, The Prince, talking about varieties of forms of governing that could take place and how that could work, other than just a monarch. And even if there was a monarch, he talked about varieties of how they could reign or rule or lead in a nation. Never been done before. Think about in the areas of Christianity, Martin Luther, John Calvin, 1500s. Martin Luther was a Catholic monk teaching in a university run by the Catholic Church. And he began to study this book. One of the things that happened in the 1500s was they got a hold of manuscripts, ancient manuscripts of the Greek and Hebrew in these universities, and were able to begin studying them. And he began to realize that there were things in here that was not taught by the Catholic Church, and things taught by the Catholic Church that weren't in here of that day. And he challenged that. His 95 theses that he posted on the Wittenberg church door was a challenge to the Catholic Church as one of them. We're off base on the Bible on these things, and we need to give an accounting for that. John Calvin came along and began to make people think differently theologically. And again, the printing press just made this popular all over the place. Can you imagine before this? If you wanted to read the Bible before the printing press, good luck. Good luck. First of all, most people couldn't read. A lot of the people couldn't read who were the commoners. A lot of them couldn't read. If you wanted to have someone read the Bible to you, good luck before the printing press. Everything was hand copies. They had what they called in the church before the printing press, the chained Bible. If you lived in a community that was large enough that happened to actually have a Bible, it would have a Bible. And it would be chained in the church sanctuary someplace. And only the priests, really, were allowed to read it. So if you wanted to know what the book said, what God said through his word, you had to ask a priest, and a priest would tell you. And they didn't always tell you what this book said. They often told you what the Catholic Church wanted you to hear in those days. And so Martin Luther comes along and challenges it and says, wait a minute, we're teaching a lot of things that aren't in this book and that are actually taught against in this book. And John Calvin comes along and says, there's more to theology than what you've been hearing. And it begins a reformation in the Christian church that is still having an impact to this day. In the 1500s, Francis Bacon introduced modern concepts. He, along with Spinoza, popularized the scientific method, scientific thinking, in terms of not worshiping. Francis Bacon would never worship science, but he talked about a way of thinking through things, a way of making hypothesis and then doing experiments to see if that hypothesis was true in real life, and if not, where not, and how can we adjust it to where we come to a truth? How can we do that? How can we go from theory to fact? Is there a process that we can do that with, called the scientific method? And Francis Bacon popularized that along with Benedict Spinoza. Galileo, in cosmology and mathematics, introduced the idea, maybe the world isn't flat. In fact, I think it's round. Maybe the earth does, the sun doesn't and the stars don't revolve around the earth. Maybe those, in fact, I think they do revolve around the earth and the stars revolve around the sun. And he introduced something that had never been done before. All of this stuff was blowing the boxes that had been practiced for millennia that began in the 1500s, all of these things in the area of politics, in the area of faith, especially within Christianity, in the area of science and mathematics, physics, all of these areas of thought and study began to be challenged. Number two, during and out of this period, there was a major rise in the idea of critiquing the biblical revelation rather than learning from it. Christianity, along with a lot of other things by the 1500s, had become very dead and stale. And Christianity, because it was never able to be challenged realistically before, not in a broad sense now with the printing press, but it had never been able to be challenged. Whatever it said was true. And now then it was being challenged. And people were beginning to wake up. Martin Luther did a great service by saying, we need to get back to the Bible because we're far from that in certain areas of what we believe within Roman Catholicism. But at the same time, what began to happen is, well, if what you've said you believed is not true and you said it was built on this, then maybe this isn't true. And this book began to be challenged for the first time in significant ways during this period of time. Biblical revelation increasingly became subject to man's mind rather than man's mind being transformed by biblical revelation. So I'll give you another for instance. David Hume, an Englishman, basically came to the conclusion, which is reasonable in to some extent. He says, you can't know anything with 100% certainty. We can't even know we exist with 100% certainty. Immanuel Kant, a German who studied some of the writings of Hume, said, well, We can't know everything for certain, but we can know that there's a God based upon reason and experience. But he left this out of the equation because he said you can't know if this is true or not. So he just made that little bit of a shift away. Number three, an increased value was placed on man's mind, going back to Plato, who had done that. Independent of God's revelation, with the old Platonic idea that the world can become an increasingly better place as we apply our mental abilities to education and human effort, this led to a growing utopian concept of life. So, if we just put our minds together, if we just forget this and all that stuff we've been taught before, let's just throw everything out. And when we threw everything out from the past, we threw the baby out with the bath in many ways. Let's just throw it all out. All we need are our minds. Let's go back to Plato's idea. He had said that 400 years before Christ. All we need are people to put their minds together, and we can make this a better world. So let's do that. Let's put our minds together. And there began to grow this hope, this confidence that we're collectively getting smarter. We're putting our minds together, and the printing press is helping us do that because I not only have my thoughts and in my school, but I can read the thoughts of other people in other schools in another part of the world now, and I couldn't do that before, but now I can. And so we're collecting all that, and there became this hope the world's getting better and better, and eventually it's going to be a perfect place. That's what was growing during this time. Number four. As the felt need for a personal God was replaced by a personal sense of human responsibility to make life work, to make this a better world, there was a growing sense that mankind has natural rights that he should and must pursue, even if it means a revolution of the social order. So we're going to put our minds together. Wait a minute. We've put our minds together enough to know maybe there's better ways of governing than a king and his subjects. One person ruling over everyone, and he becomes a dictator. Some were benevolent dictators. Some were not benevolent dictators, but they were maybe there's a different way. In fact, we think there might be better ways of governing people than through that. And they began proposing things. Let's put our minds together, make it a better world. It'd be a better world if we didn't have kings that rule like we've been used to in many ways. What we need is a different social order than what we've had in the past. Number five, the utopian ideas. By the way, before I go any further, one of the big ideas that came out of that we'll see touched upon a few other times tonight is what was called social contract theory. Social contract theory. Social contract theory, basically, for most people, up till 1800, when this was very popular, would say, we believe there's a God who gave us the unalienable rights to freedom and happiness. But he gave us the responsibility of getting there. He gave us the right to that. If we're not free and happy under our government, then we have the right under social contract theory. There's a contract that God has set up between government and people. And if the government breaks that contract or doesn't live up to their end of things, the people need to rebel against the government, overthrow the government, and create something that is working. That was social contract theory. Started with Locke and Spinoza a little bit. It moved into Hume, Rousseau, and we're going to see some others in a minute. Number five, the utopian ideas were devastated by the First and Second World Wars. Can you imagine? The world is getting to be a better and better place. If we just put our minds together, it's going to be a better place. Because we're all really basically good people, right? And all of a sudden, something happens that has never happened before. World War I, where the entire world, basically, was at war. A war like the world had never seen before, 1914. And people began to see how we as human beings were taking all these ideas and we were using some of them for good and some of them to build bigger weapons, better weapons, more deadly weapons. All kinds of things like this began to happen. And we saw how we maybe we're not as good as we thought we were. And maybe not life isn't getting utopian, getting to be perfect as fast as we thought it would. And you saw this utopian idea just burn and crash, basically, worldwide after World War I. Within 20 years, that utopian idea was beginning to pop up again. When was Humanist Manifesto 1 written? 1933, roughly 20 years after World War I started. You come out with the Humanist Manifesto 1, promoting these utopian ideas again. We can do it. We can make this a better world. We're past all of that. And then 11 years later, after that's written, something else happens. 1944, really even before that a little bit, but in 1944, the world is at war again, World War II, which was even more magnanimous than the one before it, more horrendous in terms of what the life that it took, how deadly it was. You remember how people had a hard time, if you've studied history at all, most people in America did not believe that Germany was exterminating Jewish people. Why is that? Even though we would see pictures, movies. Why? Because the world's getting better and better, and we're good people, and we're getting better and better all the time. And America was buying into that big time at this point in time. And it took years. It was well into the 50s. Before the United States would even begin to acknowledge that 6 million Jews had been exterminated during World War II. this led to overwhelming despair. If we're boiled down to our only best hope for a better life is me and you. And I look back at World War I and World War II, and the wars were getting worse than they ever were before, and the second one was worse than the first one. Are we really getting better? If we're our best hope, how much hope is there? And you see despair starting to come. If you go to young men and women today, people who are in junior high, high school, college, just out of college today, Many of them, you ask them, you excited about the future? You're probably going to hear from many of them a pause. Because they don't have hope in anything. Many of them have no hope except in us as human beings. And they're looking at the world saying, and we don't have a great track record. Things aren't getting better and better. I just don't see that. And you're going to see more and more despair in the world in which we live today. Okay, now then, with that, let's move into the five alternate worldviews. What I've done tonight on your sheets there are to summarize using some of the words of these particular writers or people of influence. Starting in 2 weeks when you see these, they'll all be quotes from them, and I'll give you the sources for it. But I've just sort of summarized here in this lesson. From now on, there's going to be straight quotes from them, straight from the horse's mouth after tonight. But this is mostly from them, but some of me paraphrasing for us tonight. So, a personal theistic substitute for God. This would be, again, if you want to write it there next to that, deism and finite godism. Deism believes there is a creator God. In fact, if you asked a deist or a finite godist, do you believe in God? They would say, yes, and he is good. If you ask them, where did we come from? They would say, we come from the creator God found in the Bible. They would say that. No hesitation. Are you talking about in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth? Absolutely. That's the God I'm talking about. Okay? But there's something different about these two things than everything this Bible teaches about that God. First of all, they would say, yes, we believe in that God, and that God created. Where did we come from? We came from the God that the Bible talks about in Genesis 1:1. That's where we came from. However, a deist would say that God created this world, and he set it in motion and left everything up to us. The classic illustration that they would use is that God was the giant clockmaker, and he built this magnificent, fine-tuned clock called the universe, and he wound it up, and he set it on the shelf, and he said, I've given you everything you need. Now take care of it. Okay? That's what a deist would believe. So that God is not involved in what he created, this universe. He just created it and set it out there, and now it's got to run on its own. It's got to take care of itself. Okay? A finite godist is a little bit different, but similar. Yes, they would believe in a creator God, the God of Genesis 1:1. He created this universe. He created mankind. That's where we came from, the God of Genesis 1:1. However, the God of Genesis 1:1 is an impotent God. He's a God who is trying hard. He created this universe, including mankind, but it's got out of control. And he just doesn't know what to do, and he's fumbling, trying to figure it out, and it's out of control. They would think of God very much like Superman, who could do great and marvelous and powerful things, but he can't be every place at the same time, can he? So they would think about him that way. He would have to take care of this instead of this, and he would make a judgment call. I don't have time for you. I've got to take care of this over here. That's their view of God. Where do we come from? We came from the God of the Bible. But that God is impotent. He's not, they even refer to him at times as a struggling hero. He's struggling, trying to get on top of this mess that he created, but he just can't quite do it. Now, there is a modern view today as well, modern area of theology, that is very similar to that second view. It's called open theism. Some of you have heard that. And it is a view of God that is creeping into so many different areas. If you have very many Christian books at your home at all, I bet you I can find some of those authors who have been influenced by open theology. Open theology basically teaches today that God is sovereign, but he's still learning. He's the greatest of everything, and he's responsible for creating, but he's not finished yet with himself. He's still growing and maturing and learning and everything, so he's trying to figure it all out too, and still growing and developing. He's getting better and better as he grows and develops as God. He's the greatest, but he's not really all-powerful. He's not really in charge of everything. He tries to be, but he'll get there maybe one day, but he's not there yet. That's open theism in a nutshell. Now, some of you may be familiar with it, and you can say, well, there's a lot more to it, and there is, but on this subject, it relates to this particular view of God. There is very little difference between a God who is not involved and a God who is not capable of being involved. Okay? The practical outcome is the same. He's not involved the way he should be or could be if he was all-powerful, almighty God. So let's look at a few of these. John Locke, we've talked about him before. One of those original philosophers, modern philosophers. He believed in a personal creator God generally, but he had no power. He had no power today. When God created the world, he gave mankind the keys to unlock and make life work personally and socially. So he created this, according to John Locke, he created this clock, this universe. He wound it all up, and he gave the keys to making it work to mankind. Guess what he thought the key was that he gave us? Our minds. Logic, reason, knowledge. We could accumulate knowledge. We could pool our knowledge. We can work together, and we can figure out this clock that God made and make it keep functioning in a fine-tuned fashion. We can do that. One of the reasons that John Locke came up with his social contract theory is that he believed one of the keys, one of the things that God's given us, is to make sure government is working well and everything. And he saw mankind, for all practical purposes in everyday life, as sovereign. We are sovereign, the people. Government reports to us. Sound familiar? I'm not saying all this is wrong. I'm just saying that's what he came up with. But that was very different than what the world had heard before 1600s when he wrote this. Very different from what they had heard in previous millennia and everything. He's the one who came up with, he's famous for his teaching that the mind is a blank slate. We are born into this world as human beings, neutral, blank. Did he believe in original sin? Absolutely not. Did he believe in depravity? Absolutely not. We're born as a blank slate, and we become whoever we make ourselves to become. Did he believe in God? Yes, and he is good. He would say that. But he created us to be in charge on planet Earth. Interestingly, John Locke even wrote a defense for God to the King of England for the existence of God. He was a very strong believer in God. It's just that it was a deistic kind of God who put us in charge. Number two, let's look at Thomas Paine. Moving ahead about a century, he was a student of John Locke, David Hume. Thomas Paine, a British man as well, was also a deist. He said, God was the first cause creator of the material world. It is mankind's responsibility through logic and reason to discover this God. So not only do we have to figure out the world, but he gave us reason and knowledge to discover him. And that's the only way we can do it, according to Thomas Paine. Mankind had unalienable rights from birth as a part of the natural order. When God created the clock, okay, created this universe and wound it up, part of the systems, he said, one of the systems he created was natural order or social order, social order contract. He created this social order that we are to discover and fall into, given to us by God. No institutions, whether political or religious, should be endured by the people if those institutions are not enhancing the happiness of the people. There's that word happiness that he introduces. So deism led to this idea of social contract or social contract theory, that God, one of his natural order, natural design things, is that there is this social contract between government and the people are in charge, not the government. Those unalienable rights, if you read, you can read books on social contract theory by these authors in those days, and you will notice a number of buzzwords: unalienable rights and personal happiness are two of the buzzwords that you're going to see over and over and over again in their writing. Thomas Jefferson, moving ahead a little bit, was a very influenced by Locke and Paine. One of our presidents, one of the founders of our country, all human beings, according to Thomas Jefferson, as well as this natural world, were created by God, Genesis 1:1. And in creation, he gave mankind unalienable rights and freedoms, social contract theory. God is uninvolved in the world after creation. There should be a separation of church and state. What Thomas Jefferson meant by a separation of church and state is different than what we hear today. Think about where he was influenced by. He was influenced by England, John Locke, David Hume, English writers, philosophers, believers in a deistic God and everything. But you think about the Church of England. There was one church. You think about the Roman Catholic Church. You think about the church, and what had happened in Western Europe was the church was controlling government. And he said there should be a separation of church and state. The church should not control the government. That's part of what he was getting at in all of that. All the people must be educated through public education. It's Thomas Jefferson, through the influence of Hume and Locke and Paine, Thomas Paine, that believed the mind was the key to our future. The mind was the key to unlocking what these systems are in life that make life work that God has created in this universe, in this clock that he's wound up. And the mind is key. So he is the one, the first one, who really pushed and said there needs to be free public education for everyone. If we as a nation are going to make it, everyone's got to become educated. That's our only hope to making this country and this world eventually a better place. Some of you may not, I don't want to read it all because I gave it to you. I just want to read the underlined parts out of that, a letter to William Short from Thomas Jefferson. Just a letter that was written to him on March the 27th, 1820. But while this syllabus is meant to place the character of Jesus in its true and high light as no impostor himself, but a great reformer of the Hebrew code of religion, it is not to be understood that I am with him in all his doctrines, everything he taught. I am a materialist. In other words, I define this below, I believe in this material world. That's the way he's using this word, capital M. He takes the side of spiritualism. There is more than just the material world. Jesus does. He preaches the efficacy of repentance toward forgiveness of sin. I require action, work to redeem it. It is the innocence of his character. This is what he appreciates about Jesus. It is the innocence of his character, the purity and sublimity of his moral precepts, the eloquence of his inculcations, the beauty of the apologues in which he conveys them that I so much admire. He was a good man, a good teacher. He was eloquent. He had a humble, gentle life. He had high morals. That's what he appreciates about Jesus. Look at the bottom of that, where the underlying thing is there. Of this band of dupes, he says, people who have been duped by the church into thinking they are Christians, of this band of dupes and imposters, Paul was the greatest of them. the first corrupter of the doctrines of Jesus. These palpable interpolations and falsifications of his doctrine led me to try to sift them apart. I found the work obvious and easy, and that his past composed the most beautiful morsel of morality which has been given to us by man, speaking of Jesus. The syllabus is therefore of his doctrines, not all of mine. I read them as I do those of ancient and modern moralists, with a mixture of approbation and dissent. So if you want to know what he thinks about Jesus, that's what he thinks. He was a great moral man, an eloquent teacher, and that sort of thing, but he doesn't agree with what Jesus taught. In fact, Thomas Jefferson is famous for what's known as the Thomas Jefferson Bible, where he went through the Bible and took out all the miracles of the Bible. Why? Because he's a deist. A miracle presupposes that God is involved in this world in some way, that the supernatural has entered into the natural. He was a naturalist, and this is all that there is that we've been given. And God does not get involved at all. He doesn't get involved. It's up to us. Now then, to be fair to a deist, if you ask most deists, do you believe in God? They would say yes, and he is good. Do you believe you are going to stand before him someday and be accountable? Yes. Most of them would say, yes, we will stand before him and be accountable. What will you be accountable for? That's where they will differ from what this says. What we're accountable for is using our mind, figuring out how life is designed to work, and making it work at all cost. That's what we're responsible for. Finding the systems and the order and the mechanisms that God has made for life to work, that's what we're responsible for. How do you do that? Here. What about here? Nah, these are nice stories, but that's not where you get it. That's not where you get it at all. Okay? Let me read a little bit from another handout you have there, the Declaration of Independence, briefly. Just the first underlined part at the top of the page. I want you to see some of the buzzwords from deism showing up here. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people, notice it's necessary. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God. The laws of nature are the systems that God has created, and God, the nature's God, is the God of the Bible that they talk about, the creator God who instituted those laws when he fine-tuned and wound up that clock and everything. Entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the cause which impel them to the separation. So they're writing to the king and saying of England and saying, we feel like we owe it to you to explain to you why we are separating ourselves from you. And they, first of all, they've said, God has created these systems. God has created these systems, and you violated it. Look at the next four lines. We hold these truths to be self-evident. What does that mean? Knowledge, reason, logic. Anybody with a brain could figure this out. Okay? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men by God, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And you can read the bottom part as well. And it gets into those buzzwords some more. So our very Declaration of Independence, our Bill of Rights, much of it has deistic influence in it, speaking about God in a different way than what the Bible does at times, and saying he's the one who gave us the rights to do what we're doing right now. because we, with our minds, have figured out these systems, this natural order that he has created. Okay? Some of you are beginning to say, I don't know about this, Rick. I don't like you very well. I'm not trying to be unpatriotic at all. I'm very respectful of our country and its history. But I want us to also look at it for what it is, not just what we would like it to be. Okay? So think about these words from 2 Timothy chapter 3. We've just gone through all this about the deistic view of this. 2 Timothy 3, 1 to 9. You can look at all those verses, but he says this in short. In the last days, people will be lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness, but denying his power. Isn't that interesting? What power does God have in the world today, according to a deist? Absolutely none. Do you believe in God? Oh, yeah. I believe in God, but he has absolutely no power in the world today because he's uninvolved. That's not who he is at all. They will be lovers of pleasure more than lovers of the God of the Bible himself. Okay, let's look at the second category. Moving right along. An impersonal theistic substitute for God. So if you ask this person, do you believe in God? Absolutely. And it is good. It's impersonal. It's not a person. It's an it. It's a thing in some form or fashion. Benedict de Spinoza, we've already talked about him. God is the all-powerful, self-existent universe itself. It is responsible for the creation of mankind. So where do we come from? We're part of God, the universe, which is eternal, and it birthed us. It gave us life. That's what it did. Where do we came from? God. We were created by God, but his definition of God is the universe is God. This is God, and it's eternal. It's always been here, always will be. And it has a power in it, a force. Star Wars, may the force be with you. May all the energy and power of the universe, of God, be with you. I mentioned there, number two, Hinduism and New Age beliefs as another part of this. You will see us talking about different people who have contributed later on. Hinduism and Judaism are the two oldest ancient religions still in existence today in the world. Most of the Eastern religions are spinoffs of Hinduism. Buddhism was a spinoff. It was a cult, considered a cult by Hinduism for a period of time. Taoism, Zoroastrianism, a number of those Eastern religions, most of them have their roots in some directly or indirectly in Hinduism. And then you think about Christianity. Christianity, in many ways, it's related to Judaism. Even Islam is related to Judaism as well. Going back, claiming Abraham was their father, and etc. But Hinduism, New Age beliefs are something we hear about all the time. All that New Age beliefs really are forms of Hinduism that have been Americanized for the most part. That's what New Age beliefs are. Believing that everything, this universe, for the most part, pantheism, this universe is God. Therefore, everything is sacred, as I talked about last week. Everything is equally sacred. That chair that you're sitting in is equally sacred to you. You are not any more important than that chair. Nothing isn't more important than anything else because we all are part of what makes up God. And everything is equally important within God. Where did we come from? They would say from the universe, which has no beginning, no end. That's where we come from. By the way, it's a short step. Think about this for a second. We talked about deism primarily. And we've talked now a little bit about pantheism, or this impersonal theistic view of God. It's a short step from an uninvolved God, okay, from an uninvolved God in any way, to an impersonal God. It's a very short step. If I'm willing to believe he's totally uninvolved in this world, it's not a big stretch for me to believe that he doesn't really exist, that this God, in this world at all. It's not a huge stretch at all to get there, to get to all the rest of them. By the way, most people for most time up until 1900 believed that there was a God and he was good. Okay? For all time, far back as we can go, they believed in some form of personal God who was all-powerful, who was responsible for creating. I told you, I think I mentioned it last week, that in 1900, 0.2% of the world's population claimed to be atheist. 0.2. 0.2% of the world's population. By 1980, same survey was done worldwide, 20% of the world's population claimed there is no God. So for millennia, up until 1900, worldwide, people believed in a personal God. And in those 80 years, 20% of the world stopped believing in a God, a personal God at all. Think about how fast this trajectory is going. What's it like today? If 20% were the case in 1980, what is it now, 2014? Okay, let's move ahead. A compromised dualistic substitute for God. This is Platonism, basically. When I first put these notes together, I only had Plato there. Then I added David Hume and Immanuel Kant, but you might want to put question marks by them because I didn't want to just put Plato, but I'll show you why I'm putting them in there. But Plato is the key. You might want to star that one. Those are the years that he lived. There are two equal self-existent eternal realities that are at odds with one another. The evil material world of life. So everything in the universe that you can see, taste, touch, handle, or anything material is evil. And it's always existed and always will. Anything that's immaterial, which is thinking, reason, logic, that's what he's talking about, thinking, reason, logic, that is good, and it is eternal. It's always existed. And these two realities, evil, the material world, and thinking, reason, logic, the good, they have always existed in parallel with one another. Eternity past, eternity future, they'll always exist. And they're at war with one another, and they always will be. And the way that you defeat evil, or the way that you keep it in its place, is to accentuate the good. What does that mean? What's good? Our mind. So you educate. You educate. You educate. Plato even went, some of the things that you can read in Plato, he went so far as to say, make a suggestion to the Roman government, to the Greek government at the time, but to the Greek government, made the suggestion in his writings, what you need to do is take the best and brightest minds from each village, each city, get them together, lock them up in a tower where they can't get out, bring them food and water, and let them think. Create think tanks in every village, is what he was saying, and let them govern. Let them be the one who come up with the rules, how life's going to be lived. And we will have a better world if you will do that. Take those collective best minds, put them together, and when we do that, the world is going to be a better place. They will make it a better place. David Hume, again with a question mark, influenced by Locke. Since there is a personal and social value in the belief in a God, and since we cannot disprove him, then we are most likely left with a creator God of some sort. There is a material world that we must live in, but we cannot prove its existence. However, religion, such as Christianity, as an organized system of faith, is destructive. So he's saying, I can't deny that there's probably a God, but we live in this world, the material world. We need to just live with the reality there is a God, but live life as if there isn't. Because it's all up to us. That makes sense? That's where I'm getting this living on two planes level from him as well. Immanuel Kant, there is a God who exists. We can know that he exists and what he is like by reason and experience, not because he has revealed himself to us. In our reason and experience, it is reason, our reason and experience that determines who God is and what he is like. So again, just that idea that reason and logic being elevated above everything else and being made into, in many ways, God, the ultimate. This eliminates the need to explain where do we come from other than to say, well, we're part of the material world that's always existed, and our minds, our thinking, is part of the immaterial world that has always existed, so we've always existed. That's how they would respond to that. Where did we come from? Okay? I'm sure that was very convincing to you all, but anyway, that's what they say. Now then, an impersonal atheistic substitute for God, naturalism, human history, or Marxism. Thomas Hobbes, back in 1500s, 1600s, there is no such thing as a spiritual being. If there is a God, he has to be part of the material world. Religion is merely the invention of people to either give them hope or to control other people. Only matter exists to him. There is no thing as a spirit world, a spiritual being called God, etc. Then if there is a God, it has to be material, if there is one. But he didn't believe there was. We just exist as part of nature. Benedict de Spinoza. Now, wait a minute, Rick. We looked at him as a pantheist, but remember, he also was a naturist. He believed this world is God. And you're going to see a lot of overlap at times in the writings between pantheism and naturism or naturalism as belief systems. You're going to see a lot of overlap in America today in writings. And you'll see some of that as we go through this semester. But God is this natural world and everything that he talks about. So even though Benedict of Spinoza would say, yes, there is a God, and it, he at the same time is saying there's not a God like we've talked about before. Karl Marx, human history, is ultimate and absolutely determinative in life. There is no explanation for how human history or human beings came into existence. Now, Karl Marx, many of you have heard of him, obviously. He was deeply influenced by Kant and Hegel. Kant and Hegel, one of the things they did before them, history had always been studied as a series of factual events. This happened on this date, etc., by this person. This happened on this date by this person. And people would study history from a rote memory kind of basis again. What happened when, by whom? What Kant and Hegel did was make a science of history. And they went back and they said, can we learn anything from history? You've heard the old expression, it's an old expression now, if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. Ever heard that expression? Any of you ever heard that expression? Surely some of you have heard that expression. If you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. It's realizing through the science of history that there are cycles that begin to happen or predictable things that begin to happen. And they were just studying that in terms of scientifically analyzing history that way. Never been done before them, at least not on the scale they did it, and with the publications that they had that influenced other people. Marx took that, and he took it one step further. He not only looked at it as a science, but he says, no, history, human history, capital H, human history, determines what happens. We can't study it just from what happens. It determines what happens. And there are definite cycles of history. It's like a giant wheel rolling along, and it's going to keep on repeating itself. And what we have to do is figure out where human history is at, where we live right now, and get on the good side of it, the part that's going up, rather than the downside where we're going to get rolled over by human history. By the way, picking up some of what Thomas Hobbes had written before and everything, Karl Marx referred to religion as the opiate of the people. It's something just intoxicates people and gets them to not really have to see life. It sort of helps them get by somehow and drugs them so that they can not have to face the world for what it really is. So there is really no answer within this other than you will often see naturists or naturalists go back to pantheists and say this universe, this world we live in, has always existed. And they would say, so we're part of it, so it's eternal. You'll often see that blend between them. But other than that, they have no answer for the question at all. It's easy to see how deism can move toward dualism, and it's easy to see how if you accept dualism or any parts of that, it's easy to move toward idolatry, which is what we're looking at right now, making something other than God, God. Creating another God, a substitute God. The last one here is a personal atheistic substitute, and that would be humanism. Humanism. It would be Darwinism, humanism. Darwinism and humanism are slightly different. Darwinism would be the belief that humanity is ultimate. So in that sense, it's a personal atheistic God. There is no God up there. Humanity is ultimate. So we're a form of God. We determine our own lives and course of action and our future and all of that. Whereas humanism says, I am ultimate in my universe and I am accountable to no one for anything at all. I am what is ultimate. So Charles Darwin, we're going to look at him. He's going to be one of our focuses here in a few weeks. In the 1800s, he is championed by both of these atheistic views. Neither one of these atheistic views have an answer for where did we come from. But it was Charles Darwin who came along in the 1800s, did his research, wrote about his experiences, his voyage on the Beagle, the HMS Beagle ship around South America and Cape Horn and the Galapagos Islands and places that they went and the discoveries he made and the logs that he kept, and he kept a record of all that. And what he did is he took an idea that had been around for a long time called evolution, that mankind has evolved over time, and he gave some scientific credibility to that, even though he didn't prove it, and he admits he didn't prove it. He gave credibility to it. And people who were looking for any credibility, any way to answer the where did we come from, where did we come from, you ask most people in schools today, where did we come from, if they've been brought up in public school and they bought into the party line, public or private school, if they've been brought up in most schools in our country, in our world today, where did we come from? We came from the apes. That's where we come from. Yeah, the question becomes, where do they come from? I know. But they're satisfied with that. They're willing to say, well, at least it's something. You see, before, remember I talked about the dates on the rise of atheism? When did it start? 1900. When did he write? Late 1800s. When did it become popular? Early 1900s and into the 1900s. And all of a sudden, it gave a lot of people who were looking for some credible way to say there is no God to explain our existence, they could find it through Darwin. And they used him, in my opinion, as a scapegoat to find an answer to this question, where do we come from? Well, we just came from the apes or the monkeys or whatever back there. Well, where did those come from? Well, those came from a lower form, and those came from a lower form, and a lower form of animal, and eventually they all came out of the primordial ooze on this planet. Well, where did the ooze come? Well, we don't go there. We just don't go there. But anyway. Let's move on. Number two, Friedrich Nietzsche. In an irrational response to his culture, Christian shallowness, and hypocrisy, he became the father of the God is dead movement. We don't need a real or imagined God to make life work. It doesn't matter where we came from. Okay? Sort of in your face. Don't ask me where do we come from. It doesn't matter. Let's just live with what we got. Now, there is a certain degree of arrogance in that. A certain degree of a lot of in your face with that, but there is some ignorance in that, in my opinion. Even though Nietzsche was a brilliant thinker in many ways, when it comes to this issue, for him saying it doesn't matter where we come from, he's going against all of the major philosophers themselves for centuries, for millennia, who've said, well, that's the first question that has to be answered for us to answer all the rest of them. That's the key to all the rest of the answers of key questions of life along the way. But he believes, basically, he would never say there is no God. He would say it doesn't matter, it's irrelevant. If there was a God, we killed him. Through our hypocrisy, through our neglect of him, whether he ever existed or not, it doesn't matter because he's not involved today. That's what he would say. Number three on the next page, Bertrand Russell. Did most of his writing in the early 19 and mid-1900s. There are not, nor will there ever be, proofs for the existence of God. If there were actually to be a God, mankind doesn't need him or it. Not sure where we came from. Again, he would go back to, all of these people would go back to Darwin and say, we came from the animals. We evolved from the lower forms of life to where we are now. And everything. Bertrand Russell was one of the first atheistic philosophers that turned things. In the past, you'll remember some of the ones I referred to earlier would say, well, we can't disprove that there's a God, because that's what people have believed since the beginning of time, that there is a creator God. We can't disprove that, so there probably is, but we just can't prove it. Bertrand Russell says, no, I want to see the proof that there is a God in some form or fashion before I'm willing to believe it. I'm not going to start from the other. And there's a certain degree of intellectual honesty about that, to give him credit. But at the same time, you'll never see what you're not looking for either. And if he wants proof, there were a lot of proofs for the existence of God that he is denying and not willing to look at, was not willing to look at. He's not around anymore. I think he believes in them now, but anyway. Phrases like, I'm the master of my own fate. He didn't say those words, but he is the one who popularized that kind of thinking in our time. He's basically telling people, get over this idea of God. Marx said religion is the opiate of the people. It just, people get involved in it to sort of drug themselves, to medicate themselves so they don't have to face the real world. And Bertrand Russell and some of his colleagues would basically say, look, we need to grow up. Get over this idea of God and religion and just take responsibility for your life. Think about America. If you've studied American history, does the phrase rugged individualism ring a bell to you? How the West was won, rugged individualism. I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps. I'm going to make life work. I'm going to do it over and over again. And a lot of that came out of these kind of thinkings that were developing, and Bertrand Russell made them more popular even in our day today. Deism, it's an easy step to dualism, an easy step to idolatry, an easy step to atheism, to believe in no God at all. You have some things there in the Humanist Manifesto 2, I would encourage you to read, especially on pages 2 and 3. If you did not get a chance to read it before, I would encourage you to read pages 2 and 3 and look for the answer to where do we come from. And you'll see some things there that they express. A final thought in the minute or two that I've got left. Number one, the answer to this question is the front door to our worldview. However we answer this question gives way to how we're going to answer the other questions. So can you understand just from the way I went through this tonight, and again, I know I'm like a machine gun or a fire hose going off or whatever, but the way I've covered this, and it's been very brief, but you can get an idea where all these people are going to go by this, the way they answer this question with the other answers. You can get some ideas anyway. If we miss the mark in answering this question, we are thrown off on answering all the other questions that follow, or we become blindly inconsistent, one or the other. 3, 4, and 5, look at these. Deism denies the implications of their answer to this question. If we have a God, but he's not involved, can he really be sovereign? Is he really an all-powerful God, creator God, if he is not involved at all? And deism does not deal with that at all. It doesn't. It just says that's the facts. Based upon what? Well, just reason, logic, knowledge, experience. That's where they go with that. Number 4, dualism dodges the question in a variety of ways. First of all, it says, well, we're part of the universe and it's always existed, so we've always existed. And then they'll come back and they'll say, another one would say, but we can't know anything with certainty. Hume would say, we just can't know anything for certain at all. So we just can't know where we came from for sure, along with a lot of other things. By the way, there is some truth to that. I think it is a true statement that we cannot know anything in life with 100% certainty. 100% certainty. If you say, well, I know that God exists, you've never had one doubt, then there was a slight uncertainty for at least a moment there in your life. So I agree with him, generally speaking. But to say that we can't know anything with 100% certainty and to throw out things, say, well, I don't need to know anything then, that is silly. Atheism denies the need to even answer the question in an ultimate way. It just settles back on evolution and says, well, we just came from a lower life form. That's where we came from. And it just sort of puts on blinders and doesn't even want to answer, well, where did that lower life form? Well, it came from another lower life, another. And it goes on back, well, where did the primordial ooze come from? Well, and then they would go back to this last one. Well, we can't know everything. And they'll fall into that same kind of a trap that Hume did. By the way, we have heard so much about creationism and evolutionism. creation and evolution. Do you realize we're talking about apples and oranges? Creation talks about how everything began. Everything began. Evolution is talking about once there was stuff here, how did it develop? They're talking about two totally different subjects, and yet we talk about like it's, you know, if this one's true, then this one can't be true, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not an evolutionist, but they are not. Number six, deism leads to dualism, leads to idolatry, leads to humanism. There's little difference between an uninvolved God and an unnecessary God. And there's very little difference between an unnecessary God and no God in people's minds and experience. And number seven, all this began by simply denying the authority and value of supernatural revelation. We made revelation subject to us rather than us being subject to it. You realize that's all these alternate substitute views that we've looked at, every one of them have one thing in common. They threw this out. Every one of them have that in common. They got rid of this and said, that is not an ultimate authority. Every one of them comes back in some form or fashion and says, this, or me, including this, is the ultimate answer. Every one of them puts all of our best hope, our future, everything in life back upon us and our ability to think and reason and work things out. Every one of them does that. Those are the things that they have in common, everyone. Let me close with a quote. Reading to you from The Descent of Man by Charles Darwin. The very end in his summary, this is the last paragraph of that lengthy book. Goodness, 600-page book. Man can be excused from feeling some pride at having risen through the though not through his own exertions, to the very summit of the organic scale, and the fact of his having thus risen, instead of having been aboriginally placed there by a god, may give him hopes for a still higher destiny. Hey, look how far we've come. Even though we didn't start all this, look how far we've come. And it gives us hope how much further we can go. Hopes for a still higher destiny in the distant future. But we are not here concerned with hopes or fears, only with the truth as far as our reason allows us to discover it. I have given the evidence to the best of my ability, and we must acknowledge, as it seems to me, that man with all his noble qualities, with sympathy which feels for the most abased, with benevolence which extends not only to other men but to the humblest living creature, with his godlike intellect which has penetrated into the movements and constitutions of the solar system, with all these exalted powers, man still bears in his bodily frame the indelible stamp of his lowly origin. Where do we come from? Mud. That's where we came from. And he said, though we may have hope that look how far we've come, let's not forget where our roots are. We are products of ooze, mud. That's where we came from. That's how important we are as human beings. He admitted from all the way through, in fact, the descent of man. It's not the ascent of man, it's the descent of man, one of his largest volumes that he wrote, putting us in our proper place. Who are we? We're of no great worth or value. That's who we are at all. Because where do we come from? Where's our origin? The mud. That's where we're from. So when he answered the question, where do we come from? And he goes back to the lower life forms, all the way back to the ooze eventually and everything. He's basically saying, because that's where we came from, we're worth nothing. We've accomplished a lot, and we have hope that we can get someplace else, but let's not forget our true value is zero. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much for who you are. Thank you that you have given us truth that we can go to and look at, and I'm looking forward so much to next week, to seeing what your word says about where did we come from. God, I think it's easy just to, for many of us in this room just to say, well, we came from God. Why do I need to come next week? God, I pray that you would help us as we prepare for next week, each one of us looking at the texts, the Bible texts that are there. You've given us so much information, so much detailed information. And God, I pray you would help us to be good students and learn more about what you have to say about where did we come from. There's so much to it. It's so exciting. Thanks for the time tonight. Thank you that we have something better. In Jesus' name, amen. You have some discussion questions there. Either circle up around your table or go to a different table or come join a table if you want to, or sit in the back around with some other folks. I believe there are questions on little tables in the back by the sound booth back here on each side if you don't have some. Let me just tell you real quick, good question came up. What about homework for next week? Because there's nothing to read. You'll notice on behind tab 3, there's a section. There are a couple pages of just verses spread out. What I want you to do is look up those verses, write your observations down about where did we come from? Where do you come from? Okay, so just write your observations down as you go through those passages and bring those for next week, and we'll go through it. That's all.